This is WGTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, vice president for community and government relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello and welcome to WGTD's Education Matters. I'm your host, Jonathan Shaler, and I'm very pleased to introduce you to my guest today. He is Fleet Mall, Dr. Fleet Mall, and let me give you a brief introduction. He's an author, meditation teacher, a management consultant, trainer, and executive coach who facilitates deep transformation for individuals and organizations through his philosophy and program of radical responsibility and neurosomatic mindfulness. He's a tireless and dedicated peacemaker and servant leader working for positive social transformation and a more just and sustainable global society. He's the founder of Prison Dharma Network, the Prison Mindfulness Institute, the Center for Mindfulness in Public Safety, the National Prison Hospice Association, Windhorse Seminars, and Heart Mind Institute. Fleet is also the co-founder of the Engaged Mindfulness Institute, Transforming Justice Initiative, UPAYA Institute's Buddhist Chaplaincy Training Program, the Rwanda Bearing Witness Retreat and Peace Initiative, and the Center for Contemplative End of Life Care at Naropa University. He currently serves as the CEO and Director of Training, Research, and Development for the Prison Mindfulness Institute, the Center for Mindfulness and Public Safety, and the Engaged Mindfulness Institute, as well as CEO and Senior Trainer for Windhorse Seminars and Consulting. I would like you to know that he is also the author of several books, including Dharma in Hell, The Prison Writings of Fleet Mall, Radical Responsibility, How to Move Beyond Blame, Fearlessly Live Your Highest Purpose, and Become an Unstoppable Force for Good, and for correction officers, The Resilient CO, Neuroscience-Informed Mindfulness-Based Wellness and Resiliency for Corrections Professionals. So welcome, Fleet. It is wonderful to meet you at last. I've followed you, and I'm thrilled to have you on our program.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you for having me.
Sure. So let's get right into it. We have a slim 43 minutes or so, and I would just like to know, and I'd like our audience to know a little bit more about how you got into this work of teaching mindfulness, especially in prisons.
Yeah, well, there's kind of two parts to that. So I've been interested in and involved in mindfulness and meditation most of my life. I'm probably, in 1966, the summer of my sophomore year in high school, Summer of Love, famous Summer of Love, although I wasn't in San Francisco, I was in Missouri, and the Summer of Love hadn't quite reached Missouri at that point. But anyway, that summer I discovered Buddhism, meditation, marijuana and LSD all in the same summer. And things kind of proceeded along that kind of twisted pathway in that way. And, you know, I graduated from high school in 68, classic angry young man, big hole in my gut, mostly, I think, due to alcoholism issues in my family and so forth that I grew up with. And at any rate, I just went headlong into the counterculture of that time, I guess I've always taken things to the extremes a little bit, so I went into that really headlong, but it was always a spiritual seeker at the same time. And of course, that whole movement was kind of mixed up with the drug, sex, rock and roll, and spirituality, and seeking, and consciousness, and all the rest of it, and still is on some level. So, at any rate, before I could untangle all that, I earned my way into a federal prison sentence for drug trafficking. I had left the country in 1972. And living as an expat just because I became so alienated from, I think it was when Richard Nixon was reelected, I just kind of had to leave. I just couldn't handle being, I was caught up in this all this us versus them thinking, and probably wasn't the most creative response, but anyway, I kind of had it. And I also, it was also, I was really looking for something genuine, and I just felt like the culture I was, had been raised in and was available to me at the present, it just felt artificial, superficial, hypocritical, and so forth. And again, I had all this judgmental us versus them thinking, but not that there wasn't any accuracy to it, but at any rate, I was looking for something real, something genuine, because in my early childhood, I had felt really plugged into a very kind of magical world, vivid, you know, sense of reality and so forth. And probably about the time I started school, all that just went to gray tones. It could have had to do with the alcoholism of my family as well. And but I always wanted it back. I mean, maybe that's even a normal developmental process. I don't know. But I wanted it back. And of course, you know, began to get glimmers of it with sexuality and alcohol and the music and drugs, sex and rock and roll, all that. But you know, some of that, yeah, there is some real connection, but it's semi-contrived and artificial. And if you have a big hole in your gut, there's a lot of baggage, addictive propensities, and so forth. So, but I was always looking. And somewhere I got the idea that I would find this in Peru. And it wasn't about the drugs. I don't know what it was about. I don't even know where I got the idea originally. It's been so long ago. But I was determined to get down there. And I started traveling with a buddy. And we traveled all through Mexico. And we were just hitchhikers, you know, backpacking hitchhikers, you know, back in that era. And you know, went through a lot of adventures. Eventually in Belize, bought a sailboat, something else I'd always wanted to do. So we bought a little native fishing sailboat very cheaply converted that, did a bunch of work on it, converted it, and spent all our money. I mean, we had probably, I don't know, we probably had $2,000 invested in it, which was all the money we had. So we had a boat, but we were broke. So then we lived off the sea for the next almost a year, just, you know, spearfishing for our food, and we'd exchange fish for salt and kerosene for the lamps and things. We're literally living off the ocean with no money. And I had a pair of cutoffs and a couple of T-shirts and a pair of flip-flops and a mask fins and a Hawaiian sling thing. So it was pretty basic, but it was an extraordinary experience. And then eventually, you know, we wanted to keep going. We thought about trying to sail the boat down to South America, but then gave up on that because it was really beyond our abilities. And but we spent almost a year sailing off the coast of Belize, where all these incredible islands are, the Belizean Keys. And so at any rate, we finally found some other travelers that were looking for a boat like we had been looking for. We sold it to them for about what we had into it. And then with that money, we continued traveling on to South America. And a lot of adventures along the way. Still took quite a while. Went through Central America, Colombia, Ecuador. Eventually got to Peru. And by that time, there were four of us. A couple of friends had joined us along the way. And eventually, everybody but me left. I stayed. I wasn't going back. I had really cut the ties to my past. My life was out there somewhere ahead of me. And so I didn't have any, not that I didn't have family, but I just didn't have a sense of going back, right? So I stayed. And I did discover, you know, in Peru, it was quite amazing. You'd wake up in the morning, especially where I was living out in the Sacred Valley of the Incas, and it was as if you had consumed some psychedelic substance, but you hadn't, right? It was just felt that way. It was that, and so I felt like I'd really found something. Sadly, the first time I ran out of money, so I went back to the States to work. I worked in a shipyards for about 9 months to get some money and go back. And when I got back to the States, I hadn't brought that with me. Obviously, I hadn't internalized that. I couldn't, you know, obviously it was local to there. And so that was disappointing. But anyway, I got back. And so I was down there for quite a while. But I eventually fell into small-time drug smuggling as a way to live outside the system. I justified that with all this us versus them thinking. Then I started zeroing in on the Tibetan Buddhist path. And there were very few books that had been published at that time. Only the Evans Wentz series, really, is like four or five books. And I had all of them up in this very remote valley in Peru, and I was trying to figure out how to practice on my own. Also, I had a meditation manual from the Taoist tradition. I was just trying to figure out how to do it on my own. And while up there, and I was working a little farm up in a very remote valley above the Sacred Valley of the Incas, and then I heard about the founding of Naropa, now Naropa University, then Naropa Institute. Some travelers showed up with a copy of Rolling Stone magazine from the fall of 1974, and they had a big feature story about the initial summer sessions at Naropa University, which was a huge spiritual happening. You know, Allen Ginsberg was there, and William Burroughs, or Chogyam Trungpa was the main teacher, but also Ram Dass was there, and Buckminster Fuller was there, all kinds of avant-garde theater people. It was quite a happening. And a lot of the well-known teachers now, Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg were all there. Krishnadas was there. So At any rate, I read about this, and I just knew I had to go. And it was really, I zeroed in on Chogyam Trungpa. I just saw his name, and something just grabbed me. I knew I had to go there. So it took me a little while to get that together, and I eventually did go, and I ended up doing a very intense three-year master's program. And there was an integration of Buddhist and Western psychology and psychotherapies, and a very intense clinical training program, really training us to work with people who are dealing with severe mental illness, schizophrenia and psychosis and so forth. So very intense program. And I did that, but I was still, you know, I had this shadow life. I was kept in secret from everybody and my teacher, and I would disappear every now and then and do a smuggling run in South America and continue to keep my marriage had fallen apart. So I was keeping those problems at bay. I was paying for my education, living outside the system. And eventually that all caught up with me. Several years after I completed my master's degree, it eventually caught up with me. And I was facing, the government was talking about putting me away for, you know, 30 years to life. And I was trying to figure out whether to go on the run or not. By that time I was broke. I had known that the government was investigating me for a while. I asked my teacher, I finally disclosed to my teacher what was going on, and I asked him what I should do, and he thought about it for a while, and then he came back and said I should stay and face it, and that if I was on the run, it would be very difficult to continue as his student, as a Dharma practitioner, but even if I was locked up, I could very much continue as his student and continue with my practice. So I took his advice, first time I'd ever taken anybody's advice in my life, probably, so I ended up turning myself in. Initially, I was sentenced to 30 years without parole. It took me a while to figure out. They said I was 35. They said I'd be 65 before I had any chance for release. I was absolutely devastated over what I'd done to my son, who was 9 years old at that time, and having to face all the selfish decisions I've been making for so long, and now leaving he and his mom high and dry with nothing, and him not having a father in his life. So I went to a real dark night of the soul facing all that. Eventually, it took a while after I was actually in prison for a while before I figured out the good time. I was sentenced under what they call the old law prior to 1987, and where there was still a lot of good time. I had a no parole sentence. That was the nature of the charge. But other people, I mean, there generally was still parole then. But also, there was a lot of good time. So on a 30-year sentence, I would earn 10 days a month statutory good time. And then by just keeping a job in prison, I get another 5 days a month that you earned as you went. So I figured out if I stayed out of trouble, kept a job, I would serve 18 and a half on 30, which still felt like forever. And then I appealed my conviction like everyone does, but I had some good reasons to appeal parts of it. It was an aggregate sentence of 30 years made up of five different counts, right? So they aggregated. Fortunately, they didn't all just stack it into one long thing, but they aggregated it. So they knocked off one count. It should have gotten me a new trial. It didn't, but they knocked off one count, and that reduced my sentence to 25. So at that point, then I knew I would serve 14 and a half if I stayed out of trouble. Mm-hmm. It still felt like forever at that time. By the time I knew that, I probably had like 11 and a half years left, maybe 12. Still felt like forever. But at any rate, when I really got locked up, I thought my life as I'd known it was over, that I'd really completely torched my life. But I was more devastated over what I'd done to my son than what I'd done to myself, and also having let down my teacher and my community. So I became radically dedicated to get all the negativity out of my life, to take all the good I'd received from my own family and from my Dharma family, from my teacher, and do something with it, to leave a better legacy for my son than just his dad went to prison or his dad died in prison, because I had no surety I would survive my time. Mm-hmm. I was in a maximum security federal prison hospital. And people died of violence there, but people were also dying of all kinds of illnesses, right? Federal prison hospital in the height of the AIDS epidemic. Mm-hmm. And I ended up with another prisoner starting the first hospice program inside a prison anywhere in the world that we're aware of in 1987. So I was caring for men. This was on my free time. I got a job teaching school. That's what I did as a day job for 14 years. I taught school, helping people learn to read or get their GED or study for college classes online. Mm-hmm. Not online, but correspondence. But then most of my meal breaks and my free time, I was up in the hospital caring for men who were dying of AIDS and liver cancer and liver disease and heart disease, all kinds of things. But the AIDS epidemic was just going into full swing, so that really was coloring all of it. And they were bringing all the AIDS patients from the federal system to, at least from the higher security ones, to this prison hospital. Wow. And so I just became radically dedicated to to transforming myself. And again, I was faced with death all the time. So I had no surety that I would complete my, you know, that I would survive. But if I did, I wanted, whatever, I just wanted to create a better legacy for my son, right? And then also, you know, as I got further into it, I realized if I do get out, and if I do manage to, because they take away that good time in chunks if you're getting in trouble, right, in prison. So if I do manage to stay out of trouble and actually serve 18 and a half, but then later I realized it would be 14 and a half, I was going to be, well, in the latter case, 14 and a half, I realized I would be just short of my 50th birthday when I got out. Pretty hard to start your life at 50 with a serious conviction on your record. And also the IRS said I owed them like $350,000, something like that. So I knew that, you know, I was really going to have to work at it and train myself to create any kind of future for myself if, in fact, I did survive. So I spent that time in prison really working on transforming myself and contributing to that community and, you know, just practicing like my hair was on fire, practicing many hours a day, studying many hours a day, and then, you know, involved in teaching school. I started meditation groups in a prison chapel, was doing the hospice work, very dedicated to the 12-step work, my own recovery, and that service work. So I was leading a very, very active life from the time they let you off the unit to go to breakfast to when you had to be back on the unit at night at 9. And then in between, I was, you know, hours and hours of practice and study. I was originally only sleeping 4 or 5 hours a night for a long time. Maybe the last few years I slept 6 hours a night. I can't do that now. I need to get my 7 or 8 hours or I'm in bad shape. But somehow I did it back then. I was very, very motivated. And that became like my monastery or my ashram time, even though that environment is nothing like a monastery or ashram. It's a very negative, demeaning, violent environment where, you know, your basic humanity is under assault all the time. But at any rate, for me, it was, you know, my time of transformation. And I got out in 1999, and all the work I did while I was in evidently paid off because I've had nothing but opportunities since I got out to travel the world and teach and serve and do the various types of work that we do.
Absolutely. Wow. What a story. I mean, and if people want some taste, a further taste of your time in prison and how you discovered this work, I would recommend again the book Dharma in Hell, The Prison Writings of Fleet Mall. But thank you for that whirlwind tour of how you launched into this career that has taken you so far. I think for our general audience, I'm wondering if you could share where your passion lies in teaching mindfulness awareness, if I can call it that, and also specifically in prison settings.
Yeah, well, meditation, mindfulness, the Dharma has so profoundly transformed my life that I'm very passionate about offering that opportunity to others in whatever setting. And I was in long enough that that really became my community. And I can well understand when some people get out, they just want to leave that world behind and never think about it again. Very understandable. But, you know, maybe because I was a practitioner and whatever, I couldn't do that. And I had started, actually, I started Prison Dharma Network while I was in. I started that in 1989 while I was in prison and with some, you know, help of some people on the outside just acting like a mail drop for me. And then later I got another friend that was got involved in creating active prisoner correspondence. And so from 1989 to 1999, for the first 10 years, Prison Dharma Network was mostly a book ministry and also setting up prisoners with kind of Buddhist pen pals or meditation teachers they could correspond with. That was what it was for the first 10 years before I got out in 1999. But so that work already had momentum, and we'd already connected with a lot of other groups and kind of created this network of other organizations doing that work. And we had a board of spiritual advisors of some really well-known Dharma teachers in the West, and it was originally intended to be non-sectarian Buddhist, right, or interfaith Buddhist across all Buddhist denominations. And then later it became more broadly contemplative. We included groups that were teaching Christian centering prayer in prison or Siddha yoga or, you know, for as long as it was some genuine inner work of some kind. And then I also started a nonprofit to promote the prison hospice model we developed in there. We started National Prison Hospice Association. By the time I got out, there were about 70 hospice programs in state and federal prisons as a result of that work. And that work got some real funding behind it, and we had and so forth. The Prison Dharma Network just operated on a shoestring the whole time I was in, and with a lot of volunteer help, especially from my friend Dan Baird, who was at Shambhala Publications and enlisted a lot of the staff there in helping to to volunteer and drive the book ministry. And they sent out a lot of Shambhala books and so forth. But at any rate, when I got out, I, by agreement, you know, took over responsibility for Prison Dharma Network. And that's when Kate Crisp, our current executive director, stepped in and got involved. And so, you know, I was already kind of in the flow of that work when I got out. I needed a livelihood, so, and I didn't want to place the burden of my livelihood on that very nascent nonprofit, you know, struggling nonprofit. So I ended up figuring out how to become a management consultant. I don't know how 14 years in prison prepared me to do that, but somehow it did. And and so I've had a management consulting practice ever since I got out for the last 25 years, I guess, executive coach and so forth. And So when I got out, I started teaching, and Naropa invited me to teach there right away. I'd actually started teaching while I was in prison, sending out some videos, and they included me as faculty in a couple programs. And when I got out, they invited me to join the faculty. So I taught at Naropa for the first 10 years that I was out. Mm-hmm. And that was a real laboratory for me to really continue to develop processes and practices and programs and so forth. I was teaching courses in Buddhist psychology, contemplative approaches to social action and peacemaking, environmental social action. I was leading the socially engaged Buddhism training program and things like that. And the other part was that I connected with Bernie Glassman's work while I was in prison, was very inspired with it. With the permission of my Tibetan teacher, who is the son of Trungpa Rinpoche, I asked his permission because I said I'd like to, you know, train with Bernie and the work he's doing with the Zen peacemakers to integrate Zen and social action. So my Tibetan teacher said it was fine, just don't get lost there, but learn everything you can, bring it back. And so anyway, I got very deeply involved with Bernie. And so I ended up becoming an empowered teacher in both these traditions, in both the Tibetan Vajrayana tradition and the Zen tradition, and still very, very involved in both. And yeah, so that, you know, has provided me with a very full life the whole time I'm out. But I'm still really, you know, I share the practice, various meditation and body mind disciplines broadly with the general public through Heart Mind Institute. I also work with a lot of business professionals, and through Prison Dharma Network and its three divisions, Prison Mindfulness Institute, Engaged Mindfulness Institute, and Center for Mindfulness and Public Safety. We not only work with prisons, but we do a lot of work with correctional officers, probation, parole officers, other first responders. And that's a lot of my direct involvement. I will go back into prisons. I haven't had the opportunity yet. They all got shut down during the pandemic. They during the whole period of the lockdowns for 3 years, they weren't letting in outside volunteers or contractors. Mm-hmm. So I had gone into a lot of prisons all around the world before before the pandemic. But the work with the correctional officers has continued, both online and direct. So we've been doing a lot of work in Oregon and Indiana, and a lot of work in Canada and the province of Ontario. So I'm regularly involved. I'm leading a couple trainings this week up in Ontario. I'll be online, but sometimes I'm up there in person. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm very passionate about that work. I'm very passionate about, I've become very passionate about the intersection between really the ancient yogic sciences of the East, as well as the ancient contemplative sciences from the West. Mm-hmm. But all that inner work and everything that contemplative and yogic practitioners have been discovering for millennia now, right? Mm-hmm. So the intersection of that with current neuroscience, especially, and also positive psychology, but primarily neuroscience and everything we're learning about the brain through neuroimaging. And today, we know very precisely the neural networks that are, I mean, we're learning more all the time. The brain is a very complex phenomenon. So, I mean, we have to be a little careful to say how much we know. We know a lot. And there's a lot more to know, right? But nonetheless, we know we have, with some precision, the neural networks that are involved in healing and awakening. And we know how to target specific practices to strengthen those neural networks. And they also have a synergistic impact with each other because they're all interconnected, right? And so by strengthening, having them actually become physically more robust, and the more neural connections, more dendrites, increase neurons, neurogenesis, and so forth, these become very robust, and they buffer us from the sort of fear and survival biology of the human condition, which drives behavior otherwise, and allow us to begin to really live more conscious, more awakened lives, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's a very exciting time, I think, to be alive and to have access to all the great practices, ancient practices from all the different contemplative cultures, East and West, and now to have access to all the neuroscience and positive psychology, and to be able to integrate all that and, you know, work with try and combine this with that and this and, you know. So that a lot of my work is that today. I'm very passionate about sharing it with whoever's interested.
Yes, absolutely. By the way, this is WGTD-FM. You're listening to Education Matters. I'm Jonathan Schiller, and we're speaking with Fleet Maul. Fleet Maul's telling us all about his work with the Prison Mindfulness Institute, etc. He's the CEO and or director of a range of organizations that promote the latest science and also the ancient traditions of mindfulness awareness, integrating these. And we've been hearing some wonderful things about this. In the, we have about 17 minutes left to go. What would you like to focus on, Fleet? This is your time. What would you like the audience to hear more about?
Well, you know, since I'm passionate, maybe I'll talk about this latest integration a little bit. And one reason I feel it's so important is because I think, I don't know if there is any data to look at, but I suspect that the majority of people that try to practice mindfulness end up giving it up. I mean, mindship, thank goodness, has really been mainstreamed. It's really out there. Most people have heard of it, or a lot of people have heard of it, and a lot more people than before. And so a lot of people, I think, try the practice because they hear it's good for them or they're introduced to it somewhere. But because of the way they're introduced to it, which I think is, I think the instruction could be better. Not to say that people are giving bad instruction. I just think they don't know about some of the latest advances. So anyway, I think people initially find it hard. They find it boring. They may get a little experience here or there, but they're not necessarily getting profound results. And they're busy. Everybody has busy lives. And, you know, so, it, and, you know, and they're, of course, I introduce this a lot to correctional officers, probational and parole officers. And I hear getting in, oh, I don't have time. My life's so busy. My family work. Oh, my mind's racing all the time. I can never do that, you know. So we give them, like, breath regulation practices that are easy to do, and they have an immediate experience that works for them and so forth. But I've been passionate about how to especially get new practitioners, you know, into the practice more easily so they don't give up, right? Mm-hmm. And then often I think even people have been practicing 3 or 4 years, maybe even have a semi-regular practice. They do it because they know it's good for them, and they probably feel, you know, if they don't practice for a few days or a week, they probably notice that. But it's not really leading to profound results for them, right? Mm-hmm. Or even with advanced practitioners who've maybe done a lot of retreats and been practicing for several decades, they may still not be having the experiences they read about in the books, right, that the great yogis are having and so forth, right? So I've been very passionate working on myself as a guinea pig, but working with all the people I teach and guide of how to accelerate the process, right? The process of healing, because so many people have so much trauma from their childhoods and adult life that need, and all our collective trauma that needs to be healed, that can get in the way of practice and become an obstacle to practice. And then, you know, and then really developing the capacity to be a well-regulated human being who's living consciously and actually making genuinely conscious decisions and is able to live in an open relational way and not be driven by our fear and survival-based psychology and biology all the time. It's no small thing to become a conscious human being. And so it was my passion. And so just to say a little about what we know now, there's five primary networks involved in healing and awakening from a kind of contemplative perspective of paths of meditation and so forth, spiritual liberation and so forth. So there's the attention network. That's pretty obvious. With any kind of mindfulness, we're training our attention, right? We have an object of mindfulness, usually the body or the breath, but it could be anything. And we place our attention there. And then when we notice attention wanders, we bring it back. Wanders, we bring it back. That's basic mindfulness practice. We also try to cultivate attitudinal qualities of non-judgment, self-acceptance, and curiosity as we're doing that. But basically, the mind wanders, we bring it back. The mind wanders, we bring it back. And so we're developing that muscle of mindfulness, more focus and concentration. Well, it actually means we're strengthening a neural network in the brain called the attention network, right? Mm. So then the next one is the self-regulation network. And that's our ability to regulate our own autonomic nervous system. So the autonomic nervous system operates most of our bodily processes, right? And it has two branches. It has a sympathetic branch, which upregulates the nervous system. So we need that for alertness. And then further, it goes into stress. And then it can go into panic, fight or flight, and aggression and all that. And then we have the parasympathetic branch, which downregulates. So that's the relaxation response, the rest and digest response. And that they're both happening all the time. And there's an appropriate balance of the two for any human activity. So if we're responding to a crisis, we're going to have a lot of sympathetic arousal. If we're kind of in a state of readiness in a high-risk job, we're still going to have quite a bit of arousal. If we're just, you know, kind of doing normal daily work activities, social activities, maybe somewhat balanced, when we want to go to sleep at night, hopefully we have mostly parasympathetic and very little sympathetic arousal, right? Or it'll be hard to sleep, right? So it's an appropriate balance for anything. Now, how does that get regulated? Well, for most of it, it gets regulated by everybody but us, the world around us. In fact, we all live in this interface between our childhood conditioning, which we had nothing to say about. We got most of it by the time we were seven, for better or worse, and then a world around us. Now, if our childhood conditioning was ideal and benevolent, which for most of us it wasn't, for most of us at best it was a mixed bag, or if the world was completely benevolent, then just being in that interface without a lot of consciousness might work out sort of okay. But that's not the case for us, because the world is certainly not, you know, an easy ride, and most of our childhood programming has got a fair amount of gnarly stuff in it. And so we're in there kind of just in this reactive state, right? And those reactivity becomes habitual, and we're just getting bounced around, right? We may think we're free-thinking adults, making free-thinking adult decisions all along, but we're really just living in a very mechanical way. Stimulus A1 comes up, and we respond with response B2 every time. We're actually much more mechanical and kind of robotic than we think we are, right? And that's all driven by the negativity bias, where the brain evolved to pay more attention to threat than anything else, because job one is survival, right? So our implicit memory is full of negativity and threat and so forth, and so we spin everything to the negative. And so, you know, that's the world we live in, where you see all the popular culture is all about drama and negativity. The news is nothing but drama and negativity. Chaos in the world, it's all driven by this fear and survival biology. But then that's a human condition. We don't need to demonize that. It is what it is. However, we're also conscious human beings. And we have to earn that consciousness, but we do have consciousness, and we can become fully conscious or more conscious, and we have to earn that through practice. But by becoming conscious, we can transcend that fear and survival-based biology and psychology and begin to live conscious lives. Now, we all do that to a degree if we're functioning adults in society, but we also don't do it to a large degree. And that's why we admire the great saints and adepts and yogis and enlightened figures who seem to have done that to a much greater degree than most of us, right? So, but now we know how to get there, right? So first, it really starts, I mean, I think for me, even being an adult human being, it's all about self-regulation. We have to self-regulate. Now, most of us learn to self-regulate in some way or another. We don't really know how we do it. We don't even know that we do it. We do it to a degree, but pretty, in a pretty small degree, right? Mm-hmm. But fortunately, the autonomic nervous system with these two branches is connected to the breath. When we breathe in, there's a slight upregulation of the sympathetic branch. When we breathe out, downregulation, right? And so by manipulating our breath, we can regulate our own autonomic nervous system, right? And if I can regulate my own autonomic nervous system, I can regulate my physiology, my emotions, thus my behaviors, and thus be in the driver's seat of my own life and follow through on intentions, be in what we call self-leadership position. Otherwise, we're just living this fairly habitual, mechanical, reactive life where we're just kind of surviving and coping and just getting bounced around in life, right? Doesn't have to be that way. We can practice simple breath regulation practices that put us in charge. If we're too lethargic, too checked, we can do a breath that'll wake us up. If we're too stressed out, which in modern life, we're all too stressed out all the time, we can bring it back down. But at any rate, we can fine-tune, adjust it for whatever activity we're doing. So that's self-regulation, and it's really the key to beginning to live, be an adult, really, and then to become a conscious adult is self-regulation. Then emotion regulation is closely tied to that, but its own network, where we learn to regulate the emotions, which is not repressing emotions. Our emotions are a very rich part of our life, but we need to be able to experience them without being hijacked by them. For positive or negative, right? We mostly worry about getting hijacked by negative emotions, anger, and we get aggressive or hurt or upset. So, but getting really hijacked by positive emotions is not good either, because then we get stuck there and we get disappointed when it changes, right? So we want to be able to experience the richness of our emotional life, but in a balanced way and without being too stuck to any of it, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the emotion regulation network, which we can train. Specific practices can train that. Then we have the really important one, and tied into meditation, is the default mode network, which regulates the task positive network, which regulates the default mode network. So when we don't direct our attention, the default mode network, a set of neural connections in the brain, is active, and that's responsible for the very noisy part of our brain. So the default mode network likes the time travel. It goes into the past to worry and ruminate about the past, goes into the future to fantasize and worry about the future, as a running commentary about the imagined present, thinking about myself, what others think about me, all my opinions. It's that chatterbox between our ears. That's the default mode network. It has its purpose, and if you can free it from the fear and survival biology, then it can be a source of tremendous creativity, and it's accessed by artists and all kinds of creative people, but you have to get the fear out of it. Otherwise, it's the source of all our self-created stress and the constant reinforcement of the self-separated ego and our separated sense of self and stress, and you know, it's that. And so the good news is there's another network called the Task Positive Network that has a mutually inhibitory relationship. We activate the Task Positive Network by focusing our attention on something. When we focus our attention on something, that activates, the default mode network starts to go offline. So we don't need to struggle with our thoughts. In fact, many people in meditation, they spend all their time struggling with their thoughts, which is counterproductive, right? It just creates more thought, and you can't get rid of thought that way, right? You can't really get rid of thought. There's no reason to get rid of thought. You just let thought be, and eventually it'll quiet down by activating the Task Positive Network. And you can do that by focusing on anything, but what I found is the most efficacious way to do that is to really yoke your attention to the deeply felt experience of the body, right? Mm-hmm. So I teach a model called neurosomatic mindfulness, and it's a deeply embodied approach, which is we have to learn to get beneath the conceptual layer of the body, even the term body, and into the actual direct sensate field, externally on the surface of skin, but very importantly inside the body, this vast internal somatic landscape. And the more we activate our capacity to what's called interoception, we start to ground ourselves and the mind quiets down naturally. And I'll just mention the last one is the empathy connection network. And all these influence each other. So we become a well-balanced, conscious person who lives in a relational way. And that starts to look and sound pretty enlightened.
Oh, my. That was a lightning tour. What was the last one again?
The empathy connection network. Our ability to connect with others, create safety, create intimacy, create connection with others, positive relationship with others. Sure. And they're all connected. They're all interconnected. The more, it turns out, the more deeply embodied we are, the more easily we connect with others as well.
Oh, fantastic. I see some of your current thinking on these matters on your website. And is that fleetmall.com?
Fleetmall.com, and then for HeartMind, heartmind.co.
Okay. You have a blog on fleetmall.com. And I saw something there recently about just how deeply interconnected we are neurologically. And it's fascinating stuff. I encourage people to take a look at it. That rundown that you just gave us, I have to learn more about that. Where do we go to learn more about those five dimensions you just described?
Yeah, well, you can keep going to fleetmall.com because I'm blogging about it a lot. You can also go to heartmind.co because I'm teaching about it. Okay. But, you know, you could also just look up, you know, you can use Google and AI and stuff to look up about these networks and learn about them. The important thing is we have body-mind practices that address all of these very specifically. And so you can start to stack practices. Like I spend an hour every morning refining my body-mind practice stack that I do. And that involves intense breath work, lots of different kinds of breath work. It involves meditation, it involves visualization, affirmation, involves EFT tapping, I'm always experimenting with different things in that stack. And I do that for an hour. Then I do my shower and soap. Then I meet my wife, where we do our Tibetan Vajrayana practice for an hour, hour and a half every morning. And that's kind of another stack because they've known about this for years, right? So typical Tibetan Vajrayana practice, a sadhana practice, involves basic meditation, awareness training. It involves mantra. It involves visualization. It involves, you know, liturgical things. And, you know, so they've been doing that for a long time. So anyway, I'm kind of working on my modern form of a body-mind practice stack, and then I do the traditional Vajrayana practice as well. But we can really be our own guinea pigs and start experimenting with different body-mind practices out. So maybe if I do this one first, it has a different effect. Or if I do this one for 10 minutes and that one for 5 minutes, and we just keep... And, you know, we can practice our way into being in this incredibly open, relational, even blissful state, full of gratitude, joy, and forgiveness, and, you know, and we can learn, and the more time we spend there, the brain learns how to get there. The brain is developing pathways and shortcuts to get there, so it starts to become more our way of being, right? We cultivate states, which are temporary, states of mind, but the more we practice that, they go from being states to traits. And so we can have a gratitude practice, for example, we do every day. If we do it consistently enough, sooner or later, and we can feel great at gratitude when we do the practice, but you know, then it'll go away. But if we do that every day, sooner or later, we'll find ourselves just being a grateful person, right? Because it's become a trait, right? And so that's really what you're doing with all practices.
Fantastic. Wow, Fleet, I'm just looking at our time, wanting to see if I can cram one more thought in here before we close out. We have about a minute. So just taking in everything that you've said and finding it so inspiring, on my own path, it resonates very much with recent experiences that I've had. I had a weekend recently with a couple of Shambhala teachers, Galen Ferguson and Arowana Hayashi.
Yeah, I know they're old friends, yeah.
Yes, and she does something called social presencing theater, which I think mm-hmm. resonates very strongly with the relational practices that
right.
are connected to mindfulness. And I find that very exciting. People can look her up if they're interested in learning more about that. She has resources also online. Where do you see the future? Let's close this out with this question. Where do you see this all going? What would you like your legacy to be?
Well, you know, we have at Heart Mind Institute, we have what you call a BHAG, big, hairy, audacious goal. And it's to reach 1 billion people in the next 10 years with experiences that help them develop faith and confidence in their own innate goodness and the innate goodness of others, which is counter to some of the other, I think, misconstrued theological notions in the West that originally probably weren't that way, but have become ideas like, you know, original sin and total depravity, the flawed nature of humanity. The more dominant view cross-culturally and historically is that human beings are innately good. Mm-hmm. We have all our challenges, all the stuff up here because of the pure and survival nature of the human condition, but underneath it all, when you drop into the depth, there's wholeness and goodness and purity and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so give people experiences, which we can give them experiences, well, they'll tap in and go, oh, all those lies I've heard my whole life that I'm not enough or I'm broken, I need fixing, mm-hmm. they're just that, they're just lies. I don't need fixing, I'm not broken. Mm-hmm. And you know, so give people that experience, because when you experience it in yourself, you see it in others as well. That changes everything about how we view the world. And then give them trauma-informed, neuroscience-informed, mindfulness-based techniques for self-regulation, teach them to self-regulate, mm-hmm. and then for co-regulation. We feel if we could reach 1 billion people with the context of basic goodness experientially, the skills for self-regulation and co-regulation, that would be transformative at scale. Mm-hmm. So that's what drives us. That's what we're passionate about. And we're not the only people doing it, so we won't. Sure. I don't know if we can reach 1 billion people directly. We've already reached about a million and three quarters people with our summits, but you know, we're not the only ones doing this work, and plus people we're reaching, they'll reach others and so forth. So
yes,
anyway, that's our goal.
And you never know how you're going to connect with somebody. This broadcast, for example, may influence a number of people that we can't have an exact count on, and they may influence further people who they speak to about this, and so on and so forth. So may it be so, may it be so.
Yeah. And just a final comment to circle back to where we started. You know, beginning practitioners quit because they're not getting results. It's boring. It's hard. When you practice in this deeply embodied way, which I teach as neurosomatic mindfulness, the practice starts working right away. And you feel good. And you're having experience. So, of course, you want to keep doing it. And then we have people that are intermediate practitioners that do it. It revolutionizes their practice. And we've had scores and scores of people that have been practicing for 30, 40 years with a lot of retreats, and they find it's revolutionizing their practice as well. And it's all about this deep embodiment, activating our capacity for interoceptive awareness and practicing in a deeply embodied way really changes everything about the practice. So newcomers, intermediate practitioners, anyone can benefit from this really deeply embodied and neuroscientifically informed approach to classic mindfulness awareness meditation.
Wow. Thank you so much, Fleet Mall. We've enjoyed having you as our guest today. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you for having me on.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Scott Nelson of WGTD. For those of you that were wondering about the WGTD Radio Theater broadcast that was scheduled for this morning, it is being taped live and will be available on our WGTD website on the archives page this afternoon. So please go and check that out. Have a listen this afternoon to that WGTD Radio Theater presentation.
This is WGTD HD serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's hosted by Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College, Jenny Tunkies, former reporter for the Kenosha News and a former chief of staff for the Kenosha County Executive, Marcia Connett, who is a Southeast Regional Consultant for Wisconsin Literacy, and she provides literacy education support and management expertise, and Xander Miller, a librarian at the Kenosha Public Library, who also works on technology and digital skills. Community Matters also shares its time slot with the 30-time award-winning WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Good morning. You're listening to Community Matters, and thank you for tuning in this morning. My name is Joan Rory, and I am here today with the Racine Unified School District Superintendent, Soren Gajewski. So